dangerous. You know, for instance, you can go to Africa, and if you're running low on your malaria pills, you can stop into a pharmacy, and you can just buy that and antibiotics just sort of right over the counter. And I suppose you hope that you're getting the authentic thing. But our next guest on West Coast Live, who had that very experience and who has written about riding trains, the great railway bazaars, written novels, The Mosquito Coast, also made into a film. His experiences of kayaking around the Pacific, of exploring Australia. He's currently out talking about his new book, which is called The Last Train to Zona Verde. The Zona Verde being the jungle, the bush. And he goes back to visit parts of Southern Africa that he's been curious about. Will you please welcome Paul Theroux to West Coast Live. How do you do? Get right here. It's good. I have to tell you, after reading the first chapter of your book, I was completely satisfied. I could have put it away. And then it just kept getting better.
Oh, that's music to my ears.
I mean,
thank you very much.
It's an extraordinary journey, not the least for which you're contemplating the end of your journeys.
Yes, I was wondering, is it worth the candle? Can I make a parenthetical comment about what you were referring to?
Sure, sure.
You were talking about the free money that the right wing think tanks were getting, and the money that people were getting generally. There's a lobsterman in Maine who once told me, "The only free cheese is in a mousetrap."
And you talk about him in this book. Because you're exploring a place that gets $67 million to encourage tourism to Namibia. And wouldn't Maine Downeasters like that money to inspire tourism in Maine?
Yeah, my rule of thumb for aid is I'm a flaming liberal. I'll give money to anyone. That's fine. You know, even the right-wing think tanks. Anyone. Rush Limbaugh. Anyone. Me. poor people.
That's very open-minded of you.
But try to convince a Maine lobsterman that you're doing the right thing. Tell a Maine lobsterman that you're giving money. They actually get $350 million in Namibia, $700 million in Ghana, $750 million that we've given to Tanzania. Because George Bush went to Tanzania and liked them. Well, that was the explanation I had. George Bush likes the Tanzanian. They got $750 million under the Millennial Challenge Grant. I said, don't convince me. Okay, give them the money. It's fine. I was in the Peace Corps. I still have the heart and soul of a Peace Corps volunteer. But convince a Maine lobsterman. Tell him that good governance, we're making a friend. It's good for their tourism website. Even though they have diamonds, gold, and oil, it's still they can't run their educational system. Convince a Maine lobsterman, and he'll say you're crazy as an outhouse rat. You know, there's the only free cheese is in a mousetrap. Don't do it. But if you can convince Alvin Ratcliffe of South Thomaston, Maine, that you're doing the right thing, okay, I'll go along with it.
And you see a lot of you report on a lot of African life, including the corruption of tyrannies, the misuse of money, the profound difference between the rich, the luxury hotel, the tourist places, and the poverty that abounds there, and the disequity, the thievery that goes on.
It seems to be a rule in travel. I joined the Peace Corps in 1963, so for 50 years I've been doing mentally Peace Corps work and actually been in and out of Africa. But one of the features of travel and life in general is that people travel and have vacations in countries where people are starving. So name a country, name any country, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, I don't know, Brazil or India or wherever. People say, we had the most fabulous time in, and then they name a country. And you say, but that's also, isn't that, doesn't the World Food Program feed those people in, you know, Zimbabwe? We saw some, you know, kudu in Zimbabwe. And you say, well, it's a tyranny and people are starving. But we had the most fabulous time.
It was the kudu carpaccio, right?
Yeah, well, yes, try the kudu carpaccio. And please ignore those people at the window, banging on the window, making gestures to their mouths. So it's that's you know, people take safaris in countries where that are having a very hard time and where, you know, American philanthropists are building schools and so forth. So It's just one of the paradoxes of travel, and it's why I don't take vacations. I don't even like vacations.
There was a time where you realized you might be on vacation in one place, sort of just hanging out, and you suddenly became depressed.
Yeah, people say, relax. I said, I didn't come here to relax. I want to look around. Wipe that smile off your face. I'm not here to relax. You know, I want to do something. I'm a Peace Corps volunteer. Get out of my way. But, you know, I was taking, on this trip, to be serious, this is an extension of a trip that I started in 2001. I went from Cairo to Cape Town, overland. And that was a really interesting trip because I revisited my old school in Malawi and I reconnected with old friends. I also saw places that I had never seen before, the Sudan, Ethiopia, and so forth. And I got to Cape Town. So that was, you know, Cairo to the Cape. Then I thought, I want to go back to Cape Town, see what had changed in Cape Town since I was there before. Because South Africa is a big, prosperous, diamond-producing, gold-producing, industrial giant, actually, in Africa. And Cape Town is a very salubrious place. It has a claim to grandeur. So I thought, I'll go back to Cape Town and then go north the other way, up the left-hand side of Africa to, you know, I had the idea Congo, Timbuktu, somewhere. But I definitely want to go to Angola. And
for which people regularly looked at you and went kind of, why?
Yeah, a guy in Namibia said, Angola's a night. It's a nightmare. And I told a man in Angola, he said, I met a guy in Namibia, he said, it's a nightmare. And he said, Namibians have a gift for understatement.
And part of what you experience there, the trouble crossing the border, the guards yelling at you, your documentation being examined, kind of puts you in a state of rapture.
Yes, crossing a border puts me in a state of bliss, bordering on rapture. You could go to Nogales, Arizona, and go and walk through the 40-foot fence. You can't see Nogales, Mexico, but just walk through. It's through the looking glass. Any border, walking across any border. This is the thrill that the airplane traveler arriving in the international airport doesn't get. I mean, if you fly into Luanda, Angola, you're just flying in. I met people who did it. And they say, you know, kind of a nice little country. I say, walk from Namibia into Angola and you'll have, you won't say, nice, you know, cute little place. Yeah, you get insulted. It's horrible. Mister, mine here, please. But change money, whatever it is. Dragging your sleeve and ripping you off. And the fringes of the country, the border, is the way things really are. And so one of my missions in life is actually to physically cross borders from Ethiopia into Kenya, Uganda into Tanzania, but to walk across and be insulted. And I don't take it personally. I think, you know, would you repeat that? Yes, you know, you're a scumbag, whatever it is. And I write it down. How do you spell it? But to document the physical movement from one country to another is a thrill for me. So that's how it went. Yeah.
How do you spell that? Seems to be one of your questions to help you get out of uncomfortable situations. If you're being offered something.
Oh. How do you spell? Well, you see, I'm past retirement age, but I'm kind of invisible. Women talk about a certain age when men stop looking at them. And in Africa, there's a certain point where you're invisible. I've got a $20 watch. I've got a $20 cell phone. I'm wearing clothes that I picked up in the market. I'm nobody. I'm a ghost. I like that, being invisible. Now, I'm a Mzungu, a foreigner, white man, white guy. So they sometimes notice that. But in general, you're not noticed. And I like not being noticed. I like being anonymous.
Somebody duplicated your credit card while you were traveling?
Yeah, my identity was stolen. My advice to anyone traveling anywhere in the world is probably use cash because, yeah, my credit card, my MasterCard or Visa card, I guess it was MasterCard, was stolen. And I didn't know that, but I got to Angola and I used it and they said, no, you, this card doesn't work. They had tens of thousands of dollars had been illegally lifted from my account. And then I got the list of the money that had been stolen. It was in Namibia, where the money had been spent and on what? $4,000 worth of furniture in one place on one day. a tuna fish sandwich at a gas station, sunglasses, tinted windows, a computer, stuff like that. You know, really interesting. A sausage. Lots of furniture, though. So I got in touch with the police, and I said, on such and such a day, you know, the 20th of November, a person bought $4,000 worth of furniture. Sure, you can trace this guy. I mean, don't they deliver this stuff, the sofa, whatever? So, but they didn't. I wasn't charged for it, but it took, they obviously, you know, someone was walking around Namibia saying, I'm Paul Theroux, I want some furniture and a tuna fish sandwich.
And a sausage roll to go. And one of the groups that you sought out were they call themselves the Real People.
Yes, the Juhansi. They've been written about by Lorna Marshall, an American family, the Marshalls, very heroic family. Went to, the father retired from Raytheon Corporation, took the family to Namibia, it was Southwest Africa then in the 60s, and they studied these people. They're formerly known as the Bushmen or the San people. Those are kind of insulting names. San means cattleless or poor people, but Juhansi means the real people. You know, most people call themselves the people. The Inuit, the word Inuit means people. And Kanaka Maoli in the Hawaiians means people. The Ojibwe people.
The Diné in the Southwest.
Yeah, well, they're people. In other words, I'm a person and you're not a person. The same in all over the Pacific. It's then when people say I'm whatever it is, Mohawk, it means I'm a person, you're not a person. The Juhansi means the real people, the original people. So they're great. I mean, they were hunter-gatherers. They're our ancestors. They were the first people in Africa to flourish. So I had, you know, over 50 years, I've had this strong desire to just go live with them, talk to them. I've seen the Marshall films. I read the books. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas wrote about it. John Marshall made films. Lorna Marshall wrote a book. So there's quite a lot. And there's a lot. They are the darlings of anthropologists because they have the skills that our ancestors had, skills of survival, making tools, chasing animals, and living in this nomadic way. Great people. But it turns out that it's something of a charade because it's like seeing Plains Indians dressed up in deerskin and teepees and then, you know, putting on blue jeans and going.
So nowadays they're in kind of a theme park, a conservancy area.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly right. And they're sort of marginalized or neglected by the Namibian and Botswana governments as sort of, you know, simple people. And so they're struggling. They don't even have water. I went to one place and I saw some children going off. Children in old clothes, you know, in old Golden State Warriors, old rejected T-shirts and things like that. And they were going to walk 3 kilometers just to get water. I mean, these are kids who should be in school. Or maybe doing something else. But yeah, they're having a tough time. But I had wanted to see them because they are the aristocrats of the planet, like Aboriginals, like you could say Native Americans. People talk about aristocracies. These are the true aristocrats.
Going back 40,000 years.
Yes, 40,000 or more, yeah, yeah.
One of the observations you make is sort of the gradation of people's colors, from white through cream, tea-colored, you know, all the way to a deep black. And sometimes it's used as a classification system in Africa, usually by whites, but other times it's used to, it somehow allows people to mix better, you note.
Yeah, it's true. People, they say they're colorblind, but actually in South Africa, and also in Angola, I noticed, and as well as Namibia, people have a very fine eye for making distinctions. There's a group of Namibians called Bastars. It means bastard, but they proudly call themselves Bastars. They're descendants of part Afrikaner, German, and Herero and San people, and they make very fine distinctions between the different hues in this color pantheon of, you know, prismatic, whatever it is, racially. So that's just one of the features of life in general. And I suppose it comes from colonialism of people ranking the races of people. I should say that Angola was colonized by convicts. It was a penal colony, much like Australia. But There were murderers, and not if Australia got pickpockets. People who were very hungry in London picked someone's pocket and ended up in Botany Bay. But in Angola, they were very tough criminals, and paradoxically, the Chinese, when they first went to Angola in 2006, Chinese sent workers, and all the workers were criminals. They were convicted criminals who were working off their sentences and who were still there in Angola, but now making plastic chairs or gambling in the casinos.
The as you sought out these various places on your journey, you said that luck made a plays a large role. There are angels of the road who will help you out. And one of your experiences, you spend some time sort of dissecting the problems of foreign aid and what it does to Africa, the so-called philanthropists, the movie stars, the billionaire TV hosts who go there and adopt a village. And despite your skepticism, you took an invitation to go speak at a conference sponsored by a UNESCO organization in a small town. You were dubious, but you went. Why'd you go?
I went because writers, people in general, should go. We have an obligation to know what's going on, how money's being spent, but also to be physical witness to things. And, you know, the word witness has its origin in the word martyr. So a witness is a witness, and a martyr is pretty much the same thing. So you're kind of sacrificing yourself, possibly, and certainly your time. I went, and I was impressed because you'll appreciate this because you're a radio guy and you're a sound guy, and you hear voices all the time, voices of people. And this was a program that I discovered they were using money to do an oral history of the groups of people who lived in this particular place. And the people who were doing it were from Norway, from Harvard, from, you know, all over. Texas, Houston, Texas. And I guess they might have been oil people there. But whoever they were doing it, they were putting money into an oral history program. And to me, that's an amazing thing. When I was in the Peace Corps, in 63 to 65, in Nyasaland, which became Malawi, I realized later, to my sorrow, that if I had recorded the voices of the old people in Malawi, I would have heard the history of the late 19th century. I mean, an 80-year-old man in 1960s would have been born before the turn of the century, born in the 1890s. And that really saddened me that I hadn't done that. There was such thing as tape recorders with tape and so forth. And so whenever people say, you know, I'm thinking of writing a poem or a short story, I say, particularly in Africa, I say, you know what you should do is, I'll even give you a tape recorder or get a tape recorder. Talk to old people. Ask them about their memory, the memories of colonialism, the memories of segregation, the memories of slaughter, the stories that their grandfathers told them. So I went, the place that you're alluding to was in Sumkwe, in northeastern Namibia, a very benighted place, very, you know, at the end of a long, dusty road. But there were people who were the living, who had the living history of the place in their heads, and the only need was someone to listen to them. And it turned out that people from the outside were doing it. So I'm not against aid. I just think that all aid needs to be accounted for.
You ask somebody about these well-dressed kids who'd come to this conference to hear about this. They're wearing white shirts, dark trousers or skirts or whatever. And what was poignant was that they were going to go to a city somewhere. This is the result of their education, and go work as servants.
Yes, you actually read this book. You know, I'm kind of for you know, that's great. That's a great thing. I'm so pleased. That's right. They said at the end of it, these kids are getting an education. You know, it's a kind of school that I used to work in. You know, I mean, for 50 years, they've been training teachers in Malawi, teachers to be teachers and students to be teachers. We're still doing it. They still haven't. There are still Peace Corps people going to the same country doing the same thing. And people in Malawi, I guess, who are educated, who leave. But at the end of this, I said, so what's going to happen to these kids? You know, they're well-spoken. They're very smart. They were telling funny stories. And they're very interactive, too. You were talking about they were wearing a school uniform. And I said, what? And the person said, oh, they'll become domestics. I said, what the hell? They said, well, there isn't a lot of work here. They'll be nannies, au pairs, wash dishes, scrub toilets, make beds. You know, it's a complex fate to be a worker in a third world country. In Bangladesh, you get $37 a month to make T-shirts. I saw a T-shirt in a store in San Francisco the other day, yesterday, as a matter of fact, for $200. It was a $200. It was a high-end store. I was just looking where it was made. It was made in Tunisia, and it was $200 for a T-shirt. Well, and they also make clothes, and you know, there are cottage industries in Namibia. What do they do? I had the experience of going into schools, including the one that you've just alluded to, and say, what would you like to do? And hands go up, I want to go to America. Virtually everyone. I mean, no one sees their future bound up in their own country.
You make a comparison between a town in Namibia, Windhoek, and Newark, New Jersey. And you point out that there is poverty in New Jersey, as there is in Namibia. There are starving people there. There are slums. If you look for it, you will see it. And in some way, it sort of argues against the aid abroad, the travel abroad. If there's something at home that you might fix or look at to improve.
I was quoting Chris Christie. He was talking about the high school dropout rate. The high school dropout rate in New Jersey is higher than in Windhoek in Namibia. And, if you're looking for trials. I mean, the end of the book, I said something along these lines. I mean, I can read you the little bit where I said, the last chapter is called, What Am I Doing Here? What am I doing here? I knew at last I'm preparing to leave. I happened to be in South Africa at that point. On the red clay roads of the African bush, among poor and overlooked people, I often thought of the poor in America, living in just the same way, precariously, on the red roads of the deep south, on low farms, poor pelting villages, sheepcotes and mills, people I knew only from books, as I'd first known Africans, and I felt beckoned home. That's a quote from King Lear, by the way. Low farms, poor pelting villages, it slipped it in there. That's Shakespeare. Anyway.
Well, and the chapter title, as you point out, is Rambo.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Rambo said, what am I doing here? He happened to be in Africa. But I was, so I felt beckoned home. And lately, I've been traveling in Mississippi and Alabama, and you don't have to go far in the South to find the places that look like Zimbabwe. There's a town called Allendale, South Carolina. Used to be it's on Route 301. It's a very poor place. They're very hard up. They have a very small budget for rehousing people. There are hungry people there. There are homeless people there. There's no industry. The industry's all in China. The Delta, the Great Delta, Route 61. From Natchez up to Clarksdale, not a lot happening there. I mean, you look there; people are living in old, rusting caravans and having a very tough time. Central Alabama, the Black Belt, the Low Country, Greensboro, that James Agee looked at, looks pretty much the same. Dimopolis, Marion, Alabama, they're wonderful people and wonderful places, but they're dying, and they could use some help. They could use some notice, but I think that in the election, I went there, you know, after I left Africa, I started traveling in the South, and during the last election cycle, people were talking about the middle class, we got to lift up the middle class is getting hammered, bring me some binders full of women, we got to do something about the middle class. Well, actually, go to Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, and there are places where you won't see any middle class people. You won't see any at all. 16 to 20% of Americans live below the poverty line. So when you're in Africa, and I've thought about that a lot, I was thinking, I got to see a little bit more of that, to see that the poor in America face the same problems, high infant mortality rates, HIV, all that.
A couple of lines here that sort of stood out. Travel, especially solitary travel, is a morbid business. All maps are misleading, and Africa maps are more misleading than others. Let's see, the Boko Haram movement, the name is in the Hausa language, means Western education is sinful. Rambo here, about the Africa line here. What a deplorable existence I lead in this absurd climate, and under what frightful conditions. How boring, how stupid life is. What am I doing here? And then, travelers often become celebrated for risking trips through dangerous places.
You're making this book sound like a bummer.
No, it's not. It's not a bummer. No, it's. I need to correct. It's not. I mean, I found it an incredible vicarious journey, and despite the fact that there's a fascinating young man, kind of an elephant whisperer from Australia, who has a terrible end, that you have your own kind of dyspeptic observations about the world, you know, that it is hopeful. There is that comes across an ebullience in many people of a human spirit that allows them to thrive in these situations of direness.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm just wandering aimlessly writing about it, as I've been doing all this time with other books. The book isn't a bummer, but I was just making a joke there, Sedge. But
you're worrying about the book sales, are you? Oh my God, no one's going to buy this all.
You're bringing them down, man. Hey, man, where's the uplift? But actually, this is a continuation of my first book on Africa. I mean, going from Cairo to Cape Town. But also, it's impossible to write any kind of travel book and not question your motives. Why am I here? What am I doing here? Who am I? Where am I going? I'm not at home anymore, so what's happening? Is there any value in what I'm doing? I actually think there is a lot of value in writing, even noticing the most minor things. The historians of the future are going to read travel books and diaries and letters and so forth, and emails, I guess, for the clues of how people live. So noticing, traveling in the most laborious way on the ground, not flying into the capital and getting, the red carpet treatment, but going, I remember I met President Clinton once, and he said, Hillary's just been in Uganda. They're doing great. I said, they're not doing great. What are you talking about, Mr. President? He said, no, they're doing great. He said the AIDS is going down. I said, no, what are you talking? Like, I was trying to be as polite as possible. They're not. Go to the north. Go to the west. Cross the border from Kenya. Look at Lake Victoria. The trouble's there. There's tribal. No, they're doing great. I said, I used to live there. I can speak Swahili. What do you... Yes, Mr. President, they're doing great. Right, okay. Hillary had a great... Yes, they're doing great. Why? Because she went in, got hugged by the president, went up the red... And I'm not just beating on the Clintons. But if you want to know a place, go by the back door. Go over the border. Get insulted. Go anonymously, not as a VIP. I'm Paul. Do you know who I am? You kind of, you know, I got a TV show, man. You could, hey, I, you know, you can't treat me this way. You have to go anonymously. You're just a foreigner. You're an alien, and you find out, like Caliph, the Caliph of Baghdad, Harun al-Rashid. You know how he found out what was going on in Baghdad? He used to dress as a poor merchant. He put a thing on his head and went to the market and said, "What do you think of the government?" Harun al-Rashid, and they said, we're not too happy. You know, the price of tangerines is a little too high, whatever it is. And he found out by going in disguise. So a certain disguise is necessary. That's how you find out. So I've put myself through quite a lot of trouble to have a bad time, but I used to find out, to find out the truth of the whole matter. And it requires a certain element of anonymity. I'm not an ambassador. I'm not a high-priced traveler. I'm not a luxury traveler. I'm not a VIP. I'm not sent by anyone. I'm not sponsored by anyone. I don't get any money. I'm not with the embassy. But I think I've, in that role, as just a vagabond, a traveler, I've found out more than than officialdom finds out.
You do make friends with people of the American embassy in one country and other places who help you out, give rides. You're relieved that one person has read Thomas Pynchon and you have a literary conversation that ties in with Africa. You meet interesting people along the way, but also to get back to your love of the railroad, there's a trip that you can take on a night train from Swakopmund. And you decide to take the bus one way because the train travels only at night, and then you're told, oh, the train is only for black people. You really don't want to go on that train. And you decide, in fact, to leave the town, to return your journey, instead of using the bus, to go on the train. And you have a very kind of human experience of one kind or another on there. But then your last paragraph of the chapter is, then we left the station, and when the lights in the coach went out, the desert was lit and glittered for hours in the light of the cold moon. I mean, to me, that paragraph is like, you know, one of those epiphanies of why you travel, not just the human contact, but occasionally, you know, the thrill of seeing the aurora borealis in an unexpected time and place, that there is sort of an ethereal, timeless beauty that you can see if you are open to it and you do something that people say, don't do that.
A lot of people say, don't do that. A lot of people, in fact, local people, I say, you're going to a particular place. The place that you mentioned, Swakopmund, going from Windhoek, they say, don't take the train, it's slow. And I said, so what? And they say, but only Africans take the train, only black people is what the guy said. But he was an African himself. He said, no, and I said, but he said, you realize how long that's going to take? I said, I'm not in a hurry. Do you understand? I'm not in a hurry. But people saying, it takes a long time. And I say, you know what, that doesn't matter. I'm a retired person. I don't have a job. I'm here to see the way things are. Freedom in life, freedom in your mind comes from seeing things as they are. Seeing things as they are. That's almost a Zen concept. But to see things as they are, you have to do it slowly. Chew your rice slowly. So when you say to someone, I'm not in a hurry, they kind of look at you funny and they say, you know, what's your major malfunction, man? You know, I said, well, I'm not in a hurry. I don't care. I'm here to, I don't say, you know, secretly, I'm making notes, by the way. You know, I'm writing a book. I'm not in a hurry. Relax, they say. I don't want to relax. I think I'll just... I'll take the bus. But you could take a plane. You could be there in 10 minutes. No. So that's, I mean, the nature of the laborious part of travel is the most rewarding.
You traveled with a cell phone this trip, which didn't exist in 1975. Occasionally you get calls from your wife in Hawaii saying that she missed you, how were things. You would have a conversation. You'd be kicking the dust, was brushing off the tsetse flies, as you put it, and you get, hi, I'm in Hawaii, you know. What kind of weird dislocation did that get? Could you segregate that from where you were? How disruptive was that?
It's not disruptive. It's nice to hear a voice of a loved one. I mean, it is a strange and, you know, it's an eerie experience to be in a far-off place in the heart, the beating heart of Africa and the green bush, the Zona Verde, and you hear, hi, Pauly, when you do, well, okay. But it's the same experience that you have that I recommend in travel. If you're traveling, I think that people say, oh, I'm going to Africa, I'm bringing Hemingway. I say, you should really bring Hemingway to Africa. Why don't you bring Madame Bovary to Africa? Bring something else, bring Pudd'nhead Wilson, bring Moby Dick, bring another book. I'm reading Muriel Spark at the moment. Muriel Spark is really a fantastic writer. But when you're in Africa, to have a book, it's the same thing as hearing your wife's voice, that you go back to the hotel just before you go to bed, read 10 pages of a book about a French adulterist in the 19th century. That's great, man. And then, okay, there may be monkeys making noises out there, hippos thrashing in the brush, but you're reading Flaubert. And I think it's a refuge, it eases the mind, and then you push on. So my recommendation is read about something else, and then it's the same as hearing, I don't know, a loving voice, I guess. It's not disruptive. There's a word for it. What is it called?
Well, Walker Percy once described something like this. He called it a rotation, where somehow you're in some situation where you suddenly see something differently. So, for instance, you know, in one example, a character was in a Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art. Somebody stumbles and falls and gets up, and he suddenly sees a painting through the akimbo arm of somebody, and he sees it anew. It's like, oh, it's taken out of its context. So you would read Flaubert in Africa, and you would be in France, you'd be looking up and you'd think, oh, I'm suddenly here. But in a way, it can make the Flaubert more vivid.
Yes, that's true. And the expression I was trying to think of was cognitive dissonance. But yeah, that's true. Actually, Alfred Russel Wallace was in the Moluccas, and in 1970, he was a a contemporary of Darwin. He actually came up with a theory of evolution himself. And Wallace saw a very old man in the Moluccas and said it reminded him of a headmaster he'd had as a young child in England. Conrad actually mentions that in Secret Agent. But it's about, yeah, you're in a far off place. He said, yeah, that guy looks just like my grandfather. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's so you see life's great tapestry there and you find correspondences. That's quite a good thing.
Do you recommend becoming an Eagle Scout nowadays? You were once an Eagle Scout. I guess always an Eagle Scout.
I was an Eagle Scout. I was a Troop 24 in Medford, Massachusetts. And you know who was a fellow Eagle Scout in Medford? Was Mike Bloomberg, mayor of New York City, also from Medford. Also a fellow, he's my same vintage. And we were at camp together. So it shows you that as an Eagle, well, here's two Eagle Scouts from Medford. One became mayor of New York City. The other became a non-entity wandering the Angolan bush.
It's the next best thing to being there. It's the last train to Zona Verde, my ultimate African safari. Paul Theroux, thank you very much for being on West Coast Live.
Thanks, sir. Thank you.
You're listening to West Coast Live, today coming to you from the chapel in San Francisco.